It's time for Let's Talk Money.
Good afternoon, Chattanooga. This is Let's Talk Money with Jamie O'Donnell and Jim Place. 267-1023 is the number starting our market day. Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 6 points, sitting at 33,546. S&P down 19, sitting at 3,938. Jim, how are you?
Excellent.
Max, how about you?
I'm also excellent.
Well, good. I'm glad everybody's doing so well. With us today, Shelton Chambers and Nick Nestor with Chambliss, Bonner & Stoeffel. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. How are you?
Oh, we're great. Glad
doing
to
good.
Have you here today.
Yeah.
Now, Shelton's been with us before. You are an over-educated woman, I would say. Accounting background and law background.
Yes. Yes.
Why both?
I just like a lot of letters after my name.
Well, that's a great reason because you have a lot of letters.
I also really like going to school.
I was
going
to say, you just dislike hanging around
too.
And you got to take something.
Yeah. Yeah. Eventually, I got married and my dad was like, you've got to get a job. And so.
Oh, damn.
It was rude. Very rude.
All right, Nick, how about you? What's your story? Are you from Chattanooga?
No, I'm not. I'm from Roanoke, Virginia.
Okay.
And then I went to undergrad at a small school in West Virginia. And then law school at UT in Knoxville, and then found my way here to start my legal career.
All right. That makes sense. I see now how you kind of wound your way to Chattanooga, ended up in Knoxville, probably didn't want to live in Knoxville, and moved to Chattanooga.
Yeah, that's true. Chattanooga is a lot better than Knoxville, so glad to be here.
You said it. I was alluding to it. I also went to school in Knoxville, so I get it. All right, let's start off today, guys. We're near the year end, and one of the things we were going to talk about, charitable giving, giving in general, and some tax considerations to keep in mind as you do that. For whatever reason, people tend to give near year end.
Yes.
I don't know if it's the holiday spirit or if it's more tax oriented, but it seems to be a thing.
The other thing is when you think law firm, you think legal. You all have legal expertise, and you have tax expertise, and you work on fairly complicated issues that are out there, and that's the reason we can go across that line today and work in both areas.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, it's the year end. I also don't know why it's usually
kinda,
year end, but that is when people are doing a lot of their giving, both charitably and maybe giving to family members, things like that. So the questions we get asked most frequently are, you know, what, in regards to charitable giving, it's what should I give? What limitations are there? What type of assets should I give? Should I just give cash? Should I give something else? And then in regards to giving to family members or friends or whomever, you know, how much should I give? Is there an issue, you know, before, really, right now, a lot of times lately, what I've been getting is, what are the income tax implications for this gift that I'm going to give? So if I, Jamie, if I want to give you $100,000, are you going to recognize that as income?
Please feel free.
I really should have flipped that. Jamie, when you give me $100,000. So what the short answer to that is, if I'm just giving you cash, that's not taxable income to the recipient. That's just a gift.
Now, nor is it deductible to the donor.
Sadly, it's not deductible to
because neither of us are charities.
And the only thing as the giver that I've really got to disclose is a gift tax within the framework of my tax return.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people confuse that. If I gave somebody above, you know, the limit where it went against my unified credit, that unified credit's $11 million. So if I give Jamie $1 million, it doesn't have any tax impact to her. And for the most part, unless I have an estate tax problem, it doesn't have any impact to me when it's said and done.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So right now you have an annual exclusion against gift tax of $16,000. So you could give $16,000 to really any number of people, 32 if a spouse joins in that transfer. And to the extent your gifts to individuals are below that annual exclusion amount, no gift tax returns even required.
Now, if I turned around, instead of giving her $16,000, I turned around and gave Jamie $116,000.
Right.
I still don't have a tax liability, but now I've got that $100,000 is going to go against my $11 million.
Exactly. If you had already given her $11 million,
then it would have.
And then you gave her an additional
$100,000. Then it's probably going to have an estate tax impact.
Yeah.
But we're talking about big numbers before you get to the point that you you have tax responsibility, but not necessarily tax liability.
You have a filing responsibility.
Yes,
you're absolutely right.
Yeah, that's a really good way to distinguish it. I wish there were some element of truth to this conversation because y'all have thrown out high dollar amounts and I was the reference point for all of them. But unfortunately, there is no truth to it.
Pure example.
I keep offering to receive any monies at all, and thus far no.
Now, so what is the theory behind you have historically wealthy families, and they make these annual gifts. So what is the purpose of making these gifts?
The biggest purpose is, if you've got a lot of wealth, the reason to do it is to reduce your wealth. If you, and especially if you're combining it with a spouse, you know, if you've got, let's say, five people that you like to give to every year, and you're giving total $32,000 if you're married, or 16 if you're not, that adds up. And if you do it year after year after year, it adds up, just like contributing to your IRA. You know, that we tell people contribute the maximum amount every year because it snowballs into something huge. Now, same thing with the gifting.
You know, what we really find in the real world, it's not for a huge majority of Americans. What you'll find yourself in a situation where you've got a reasonable amount of money, not millions and millions of dollars. You've got a 25 or 30-year-old daughter or son. They've just got married. They want to buy a first home, and I want to either loan them and or give them 25, 30, or 50, something maybe over the exclusion rate for a down payment. That ends up being the real world for a majority of people, where they run into it on a one-time basis, not where they're gifting $50,000 to 25 different people over an extended period of years. And so what we're really saying is number one, should you distinguish the difference between a gift and a loan? If you're giving the money to your child, but you expect them to pay it back,
you
need a loan agreement, don't you?
Absolutely. Yes.
And there is going to be government imputed interest on that. You can't just say it's interest free.
Yeah, you definitely can't say it's interest free.
Yeah, so the IRS sets tables and they come out once a month governing kind of the lowest rate that you can charge for interest, depending on the term.
It's called imputed interest, basically.
Yeah, and it's the AFR rate. And right now, I think it's, say, 4.5% for December for kind of the midterm loans, somewhere in that ballpark. So if you go below that number given by the IRS, then they're going to impute interest. If you're at that AFR rate or higher, then that interest rate that you select is okay.
Now, so if I were making a loan to my daughter and she were paying that loan back over a five-year period of time, whether I charge her interest or not, that imputed interest is ultimately going to be determined to be income for me.
Correct.
Whether I collect it from her or not is not the Internal Revenue Service's problem.
That's right. Correct, yeah.
Right.
It will show up. You will have to include it on your tax return, whether you're collecting, which is a choice. If you don't want to collect it, you're just going to pay the tax on it as though you did.
Now, how often do they not?
Am I wrong? That you are wrong on that. So if you don't collect it, so people are cash basis taxpayers, which means you really only recognize income in the periods at the point in which you receive it. So if you don't ever collect on that note, then you're not recognizing that income. If you die, though, and you've got this note sitting out there, whether it's actually written or not written, whether there was a low interest rate or not, then in determining what your estate is truly worth, that's when you then impute that interest and address it at that point. If you say, I'm going to loan Jamie $100,000 and 0% interest, and she's going to pay me back 25% this year, that's when I think that's what you were getting to. Mm-hmm. And you're right. Even if you said, oh, no interest, if you paid back $25,000, there's an imputed interest rate that is going to be the interest income that you recognize.
Now, what does the real world do? The real world does a couple of things, and you stop me if I'm wrong. I gave Jamie the $50,000. I don't put it on my gift tax reform. I don't have
you,
her. Because
you probably didn't know you needed a gift tax form.
I don't have her sign a note. Mm-hmm. And either I'm telling her it's a gift or I'm telling her pay me back when you can. Mm-hmm. That's the real world. That's the real world, but mm-hmm. that's not the legal world if the transaction gets audited.
Right. Well, and the other thing too is, you know, with my clients that have tax, if you don't have a taxable estate, it winds up being a moot point.
It's
just irrelevant.
Yeah.
If you do wind up having a taxable estate, you know, you're going to have someone come and prepare the estate tax return. We make our best efforts, but we're not going to go back 50 years and look through every single bank account. I mean, do the right thing, make good choices. But at the end of the day.
And neither is the IRS, mostly, unless you've just clearly done fraudulent or something of that nature.
Exactly.
You do the best you can.
I mean, if you consistently give $1 million to your favorite tax attorney, who just so happens to be named Shelton, if you give her $1 million every year and you're not reporting it anywhere, and then you die, at some point,
that's going to be a problem.
That's noticeable.
When the fact that your account has increased $1 million is going to be noticeable, too. They're yes. going to look at your salary and say, where the hell did the other $900,000 come from?
Yeah, I think Chambliss is going to really wonder where all that is.
267-1023 is the number. This Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money. Talk Radio 102.3.
We're back with Let's Talk Money. 267-1023 is the number. With us today, Shelton Chambers and Nick Nestor with Chambliss, Bonner & Stoeffel. We talked about giving friends, family, that type of giving. Let's touch in a little more detail on charitable
yes.
giving.
You want to take it over?
You got it.
Okay, so charitable giving. I do. One of the things I think the reason that they might wait till the year end is because they're trying to figure out what is my income for the year.
Yes.
And what's the best way to give. So there's a couple of different things. I mean, you can give anything you want to, but the most frequent are cash gifts. Just, you know, I'm going to write a check. Well, who writes checks? But I'm going to Venmo. I'm going to, you know, whatever, to charities. That's the most common. Then you've got gifts of stock. Mm-hmm. This is another one of the most common types of gifts that you're making. So you're going to give your appreciated stock. I usually, if you're going to make big gifts to charities, that's what I usually tell people to do. Don't deal with the cash. Do the stock. Because if you've got stock that you paid $10 for and it's now worth $20,000, you can give that stock and recognize a charitable gift of $20,000, and you've not had to recognize the gain associated with cashing it out, liquidating it to make the gift. So it is it's a really tax efficient way to contribute to the charities that you're passionate about. In the way that really is the most tax efficient way.
It really is, and you give something with extremely low base if you have it. Mm-hmm. And my husband and I did do this year for the first time, and it was the perfect thing to give because there was basically zero basis in it. It was the amount. It's what we came up with the amount. It allowed us to not have to deal with the taxes, mm-hmm. and it benefits that we achieved the goal on multiple fronts in the most tax efficient manner.
Yeah. So when the charity liquidates it, they don't have to pay tax on it.
Right.
Because they're a tax exempt entity. So they don't have to pay tax on it. And then for you, because it's publicly traded stock, the reporting for associated with making that gift is a lot lower than if you were giving something that's not publicly traded stock. So it's a really easy. It's easy to put on your return. It's just a lot easy. It's one of the easiest things to do. Another easy way, if you are if you have a large retirement account, and particularly if you have required minimum distributions,
yep.
if you're required to take minimum distributions from your IRA, so you're 72 or older.
Actually, that's a weird part of that rule. They didn't change the 70 and a half for
Okay, good point, Jim. Super good point. Yeah, so you can start doing this when you're 70 and a half. You're not required to take distributions from your IRA until you're 72.
Yes.
But if you want to, if you have an IRA, if you're older than 70 and a half, and you've got an IRA and you're making substantial, or any any charitable deduction, charitable gift, you can make what's called a QCD.
Qualified charitable distribution.
Yeah. So what that is essentially making the charitable distribution directly from your IRA to the charity.
And that would also, if I were 72, would satisfy my RMD.
It satisfies your RMD.
If I had a $500,000 account and my RMD was $20,000 my first year and I wanted to give $20,000 to my church.
Exactly.
I get the $20,000 out of there. I don't have to pay the tax on the $20. I was required to take it out and pay the tax on it no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
If I were going to make the gift anyway, there's absolutely no reason for me to give cash out of my bank account when I can gift them basically the equivalent of the RMD.
And the benefit of it is it's never, if you do it that way, it's never going to hit your adjusted gross income on your tax return. And so a lot of people are like, well, I mean, what's the difference? If it's going to be a deduction anyways, what's the difference? Well, the difference is if you're taking medical deductions, for example, you can only take on your tax return, you can only deduct medical expenses that are in excess of 7.5% of your AGI. Well, if your AGI includes that $20,000 of RMD, you've got to have $20,000, you know, you've got to have way more of medical expenses. But if that charitable deduction goes straight from your IRA to the charity, it's not hitting your AGI. And so the amount that you have to exceed before you can deduct is a lot lower. It affects your income tax brackets. It affects, you know, being able to not hit your AGI is incredibly helpful.
That's important. And the other, I mean, if you're given enough, this example isn't going to be relevant. But for people that are given, say, $5,000 or $10,000 a year, they don't have a mortgage, they don't have any medical expenses, they wouldn't have been able to deduct that in the first place because they wouldn't be over the standard deduction amount.
Well,
absolutely.
Here's an issue that you run into when you're throwing all these letters out, AGI or whatever it would be. The constant refrain that I give back to people is, most of the time when you get beat on what you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
In essence, what's the good financial advisor or the good attorney and or the good accountant is going to do is lay out what your options are and let you know at the end. It's not required that you know. It is required that you find out.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the time people will come back to us after they've done the transaction a year and a half later and the ship has sailed. At that point, the accountant's doing nothing but crunching numbers. There's no planning involved in the aftermath.
Yeah.
Well, that's something Shelton and I talk about pretty often is when we're in the context of gifting, whether that's charitable or gifting to family members, we can build a plan that makes perfect sense from the number side, from the planning side. But if the client's not going to be comfortable with that plan, then it's not in their best interest. And that's something we really try and do and make sure people are comfortable with the plan. And they're not just looking at it from, oh, this, you know, charitable gift makes a lot of sense from the tax side, but does it make sense from the full financial side? And that's a consideration people need to take in.
That's a good point. And I would say, very generally speaking, everybody's circumstances are going to be different. But if you have RMDs, if you're going to give money, put that out there first. You're doing this no matter what, and you can financially afford to. If you're taking RMDs and you don't need all that money, that's the first place mm-hmm. I'm going to give money.
Yeah.
The second place I'm going is the appreciated, really, truly appreciated stock route.
Yeah.
Low basis, high value. Third's probably the cash route, mm-hmm. but let's touch on the fourth. And this is where I think things get a little more complicated. you have an antique that you want to give to the church.
Mm-hmm.
What's that look like? And does it really get more complicated, or does it depend on the value of it? What is there to that?
It depends on the value.
Yeah, it very much depends on the value. Because when you have to, if you're not taking the standard deduction,
right,
and
you're gonna itemize,
then you have to be able to substantiate the value of that asset. And how do you do that? You get an appraisal of it. You know, appraisal of real estate is pretty common. An appraisal of this rare antique that very few people appraise, and you're having to find the one person in the country who appraises this specific asset and is qualified to do so, that can be pretty tough. And without being able to properly substantiate the value, you're not going to be entitled to that charitable deduction.
Well, I go back.
Do you guys know off the top of your head what the dollar limit is where appraisal is required? I don't.
$5,000.
Okay, that's what I was thinking, but I didn't feel good about my answer.
And there's kind of this window between $500 and $5,000 that you get into too. So when I was actively, you know, when I was working at a CPA firm and preparing tax returns, I would have clients that would prepare these elaborate lists of everything they had given to Goodwill and the value of what they'd given, and they'd come back to me with, you know, well, I've given $10,000 worth of clothes to Goodwill. And so I think it's important to know that, you know, like for something like that, for something that you're giving to Goodwill, there is kind of a standard, okay, you can only take what is a certain type of value for that.
There's a list, actually, that's on the internet. You can Google it, and it tells you.
It'll say,
you can't exceed this for this.
Yeah, like a T-shirt is, you know, so you may have a pair of, what's a really expensive pair of shoes? You may have a
Gucci.
Jimmy Choo.
$5,000 pair of Jimmy Choo's. And you're like, look at me giving this to charity. That's $5,000. No, shoes are like $25. It doesn't matter if it's Jimmy Choo's or if it's
Target.
and so that is what it is. So a lot of time, and then once you get into the, okay, now the substantiating it. So I would have clients that would have these huge lists, and I would come back to them and say, it's $500. That's all you're going to get. It's just $500. I'm not going to put any more because it's going to cost you more to do the reporting you need than the tax savings you're going to get from that. So there is
That's
certain
a
component
point.
Of, like, let's be reasonable and make good choices.
I'll give you an example, too. This was a tax case that was resolved through the courts and the Internal Revenue Service sued an individual. I mean, and I guess the ruling really came out about 3 or 4 months ago. Out of Phoenix, Arizona, a woman had Indian artifacts. The artifacts was determined to be about a $2.5 to $3 million value. She ended up giving it to the museum. She ended up declaring the write-off, and ultimately it was rejected by the Internal Revenue Service.
Mm-hmm.
And it was rejected by the Internal Revenue Service because she didn't get the disclosure that she had no benefit coming from the charity. She got the disclosure, but she got it after the fact instead of before the fact. There's where a simple rule cost her $400,000 in taxes simply because somebody didn't do their job on her behalf.
In my opinion, crazy that the IRS went that way, but technically it's the law.
Well, and they are really cracking down on charitable gifts and the requirements, because the requirements are incredible. This is one of the few sections where I'm like, well, these are very clear requirements. And so one of them is that you get that letter from your charity before you file the return. They cannot be more clear about that. And so, again, pulling back from when I was at a CPA firm, I'm not going to get for every $25 deduction from my clients, I'm not going to say, do you have your acknowledgement form? But for my clients that had $10,000, $20,000, $100,000, $500,000, I made sure that I had that in the file so that if their return was audited, I could say, bam, here you go. Here's our acknowledgement. We've had it since we filed this return. No question about it. The other thing, though, and I thought this is where I thought you were going to go, who's a qualified appraiser? So if you have an ancient Indian artifact that, you know, that you're giving to a museum, and you have someone from a contemporary art museum appraise it, are they qualified when they don't know the first thing about
ancient? Well, I know in this particular case, the museum itself couldn't be the appraiser. And they were the chief appraiser in that part of the country for that type of artifacts.
Exactly.
So they did find enough. They did. There was no issue with where the appraisal was. They really crossed their T's and dot their I's there. But you're right.
But they need to be an appraiser that does that.
Well, and that understands exactly what it is. So I know you're not going to like this example, but cryptocurrency, for example. If you're going to make a charitable gift of cryptocurrency, there's not a single person in the – last time I checked, there's not a single person in the world that is currently qualified to value cryptocurrency.
What?
Right.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait, this is fascinating.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to put their name on that.
No, it's not that. It's not that. I feel like there's plenty of people that pay them enough will put their name to it. It's not that. It's that the IRS has not because it's not – what is it? What – we were just talking about this earlier. What exactly is cryptocurrency? We don't know. But there's no one in the world that has the qualifications that the IRS will accept to value something that nobody knows what it is.
Well, that is fascinating.
Yeah. So I guarantee you, if you're making charitable gifts of cryptocurrency over $5,000,
you better not be deducting.
Don't put it on. I wouldn't put it on your tax return.
267-1023 is the number. This Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back. We're back with Let's Talk Money. 267-1023 is the number. With us today, Shelton Chambers and Nick Nestor with Chambers, Bonner and Stoffel. All right, we're going to try to make this next topic understandable, but I'm going to start with it's complicated. And what it is are the rules that have changed around inherited IRAs. It used to be, I can cover this part, it used to be you inherited an IRA and you could stretch out your distributions over your lifespan. There was a table. Yes, you had to take required minimum distributions, but they worked essentially like a normal required minimum distribution would work.
Now, we're talking a non-spousal.
Non-spousal, yes. So that would be Jim dies, I inherit his IRA, I have to take required minimum distributions based on my life expectancy because he is not my spouse. Mm-hmm. Spouses, different rules, IRA goes to them. Mm-hmm. Enter the Secure Act in 2019. It changed all that. And essentially, there's exceptions to this, and there are groups of people that can still utilize the stretch. But for most people, you had 10 years to take it out. Then things started to get confusing. You want to start, Shelton, with who falls into maybe the exceptions and then who would fall into the 10-year category?
Yeah. Yes. Okay, so exceptions. Obviously, your spouse.
Yes.
Other exceptions are people that meet the definition of disabled according to the IRS.
Yes. Children, minors.
Minor children. But then there's
minor children until they reach the age of 21, and then they have to begin the 10 years.
Well, but I also think that that's a state-by-state analysis. So in some states, it might be 18. So minor children. If someone is more than, I think, 10,
who is not more than
not,
10
not
years.
More yeah. than 10 years older than the decedent. I think if you stand on your left foot when the I'm just kidding. But I mean, there's all set. But for the most part, unless you're the spouse or a disabled, those are kind of the two biggest ones,
yes.
Spouse or a disabled child, or I'm sorry, disabled individual. It doesn't have to be your child. Unless you're a spouse or disabled individual, you're now subject to this 10-year rule. Here's the thing that kind of just makes me real angry. when it first came out, there was indication that that really meant that as long as everything was distributed by the end of 10 years, you were good to go.
Yeah, there weren't going to be any required minimum distribution.
That's what the law that came out of
clear indication.
The legislative branch
yes.
said get it all out within 10 years.
Yep, just 10 years.
Then it went to the IRS and something happened.
So then they issue this thing in, was it February?
Yes. Yeah, it was early this year.
Their, quote, clarification, which really was a rewriting of the damn law.
It was a full rewriting.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
I'm not salty about it at all. And it was also a rewriting of it after it had already come into effect and after you had advised clients.
It had been in place multiple years.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So the IRS comes out and is like, JK, we want you to make distributions each of the 10 years. Mm-hmm. Now, I will say they have since clarified. They issued a new statement in October that basically said, we're not going to penalize you if you did not take the distributions in 2020 or 2021. In 2020, you didn't have to.
2021 or 2022, as long as you start in 2023.
That's right. Yeah. So the biggest takeaway for someone who inherited an IRA from an individual that passed away after December 31st of 2019, it's okay that there was no RMD in 2020. So that's the confusing part of that, COVID. 2021 and 2022, you're okay. Supposedly, you are supposed to begin taking distributions in 2023 unless the IRS changes its mind again.
Yes.
And the other aspect of that is, I mean, even with a 10-year rule and a required minimum distribution, let's say a 40-year-old inherits the IRA.
Mm-hmm.
That 40-year-old that inherits the IRA is doing their required minimum distribution based on their age at 40.
Do we know that yet?
Yes.
Have they fully said the...
I believe that's right.
Because I was wondering that this morning.
What will screw people up a little bit, if they're just doing that minimum, they're going to get to that 10th year and they may still have 60 or 70% of the money in there.
So you need to do your own math.
You've got to do your math on this 10 years relative to the tax brackets that you're in.
So here's the other thing is that let's say you inherit your IRA from your parents and you're 63 years old. The reason that we liked the ability to wait until the end of the 10th year is, okay, so you're about to retire, but you're not going to retire for another 3 or 4 years. If you wait until you're retired and to start taking out these substantial distributions, you can do that in years in which your income is a lot lower.
Thus, your tax rate is lower.
And that was the entire reason for the clarification of this law. They purposefully wanted to trap people so that they would be in higher tax brackets. Mm-hmm. When they were doing their, and they wanted to eliminate all planning where you could do that thing and push it into years where you had a lower bracket.
Yeah.
They wanted to get the most money. It wasn't just from billionaires. They wanted to screw Mr. and Mrs. Jones, Uncle Bob, and everybody else in the process. It's despicable.
I mean,
it's the way it is. It's the way it is. But when you saw how this went, look, if Congress had intended that, put it in the damn law when they pass it. To come back and see some rewrite by people that didn't vote on it. Well, for bureaucrats to come and say, no, that's not really what we meant. We meant something 180 degrees in the opposite direction because we want to get the most money from everybody.
I don't know if it was as much about getting the most money. I mean, I don't know that
why would you
technically
do it otherwise?
Benefits the IRS. My guess is somewhere in there, in the big old code or somewhere in those revenue rulings somewhere, they had a precedent for how to handle this stuff. And they went to precedent.
I don't know.
I haven't heard that, but
I don't know if there is a precedent for that.
So they did just kind of
go rogue?
They may have.
You got to think about it, too. The IRS, they've got to make some money.
Fair enough.
We've kind of got to pay back all that's happened the last couple of years. And so I think to an extent it was a function. It's kind of like the to kind of get off track a little bit, like the PPP loans,
yep.
when it was very clear that that Congress did not intend for it to be income or for the deductions to be limited, but
yep.
the IRS was like, no. And so Congress,
and they had to come back.
Congress had to come back. But I think that this is just, to me, I think it's just another, it's an example of, you know, well, they're kind of overreaching in the hopes that they'll get income sooner, so that they can start paying back some of this stuff.
267-1023 is the number. This Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money on Talk Radio 102.3.
We're back with Let's Talk Money. 267-1023 is the number. Let's go to the phone lines here quickly. Hi, James. How are you?
Hey, guys, real quickly, the people that were on the lifetime distribution, is there's not been any change on that, right?
You are correct, James. If you were on that before this, if you inherited the IRA prior to December 31st of 2019 and you're taking the lifetime distributions, mm-hmm. you are in good shape and you don't have to change anything.
Yeah, it really only applies if you're if the date of death.
About 80% of my Roth contributions now.
Say that again, James.
I said my RMD is making about 80% of my annual Roth contribution.
Thanks, James. We appreciate the call. I think the important thing, and here's where it's going to get real confusing for some people. People that already had a couple inherited IRAs,
mm-hmm.
they may have one or two that are on the old set of rules. They may have ones that are on whatever these new rules end up being, which we don't have a final answer on yet.
Well, and there's more legislation that's kind of in, like there's Secure Act 2.0 that's coming
yep.
out. There's, you know, so I feel like it's ever evolving. Hopefully, if they're, you know, whatever guidance, whatever new legislation comes out, my hope is that they'll say, okay, we're going to back this up to, you know, Secure 1.0 and not have 15 different measuring periods.
It would be nice if there were an element of consistency to
yeah.
all of this. And
yeah.
if you could get answers before the laws went into effect and you don't
Overrated.
Know what to do. The main takeaway right now is you don't have to worry about this year and you
yeah.
don't have to worry about last year. Unless something changes, you will have to worry about it next year.
Yeah.
But that is maybe between now and the end of the year, they'll announce something. So we'll actually know.
Fingers crossed. But I do, I mean, for people that were advised, correctly advised, in my opinion, don't take distributions. Wait until, you know, you get closer to the 10-year period. Revisit that.
Sounds like good advice. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Shelton. We enjoyed it.
Thanks.
Coming up next, The Ramsey Show, 1 to 3, 3 to 7, Sport Talk. We'll talk to you all tomorrow.